All right, I'm going to go over a few additional, you know, using these different tools. That's one weed control strategy. I'm going to go over some other weed control strategies that we have or are using. The first one is called the stale seed bed.
Have you got notes on these?
I do. And I'm hoping I can have them for you at least after lunch. So, yeah. So the idea on the stale seed bed is it's recognizing that you have this bank of weed seeds in your soil, and that whenever you work your soil, those weeds are going to want to come up. And so what you do, this is particularly the place we use this is when we're wanting to direct seed. This is where the strategy works best. So what the idea is that you prepare your bed how you want to prepare it. And then before you seed, you sprout your weeds. So you either water the bed or maybe you make the bed right before a rain's supposed to come. And so you let them be watered and you sprout those seeds. And then you can either use the collinear hoe or something like that to just very, very shallowly take out those seeds that have just germinated. We're dealing with them at the white thread stage. Or if you're a little more a little more serious farmer and more advanced, there is something called a flame weeder that you can use to, you know, you take a bottle of gas on the, it's a machine. So there are some that you just have a gas tank on your back and it's like a torch and you just go like this. But then my nephew has come up with one that's on wheels that will straddle a 30-inch bed. And then it has, I think, 5 torches underneath that come down so you can just flame your whole bed all at once, one pass. And, that'll kill your seeds on the surface. And then after you've done that, you can direct seed in the bed and your weed pressure will be reduced significantly. It's not going to be eliminated, but it'll be reduced. But, you know, you can just do a shallow cultivation and take those seeds out. And sometimes when we know that we have a really heavy weed pressure in that soil, you might even do it 2 or 3 times before you actually plant your seed. So there's a timing issue on that because you've got to wait about 2 weeks, you know, somewhere around 2 weeks between when you've prepared the bed and when you can do that cultivation at the white thread stage. Okay. 10 days to 2 weeks. So if you might put yourself a month out if you do it several times or more. But that's a good way of taking care of reducing weed pressure on direct seedings. And so we particularly highly recommend this for carrots. Remember I said carrots they germinate slower than most other seeds. And if you have heavy weed pressure and a lot of carrots that you've just seeded, that's a pain. That's all I can say.
I noticed
God puts out a little email to the people who buy for his garden.
Uh-huh.
And he told them that he sowed his carrots in the bed and
yeah.
then did the flamethrower 2 days before he expected the carrots to come up to go away.
Yes.
So he already sowed it. So
you can. Yeah.
But he assumed the weeds would be up before the carrots and he'd get them a couple of days before the carrots.
Right. You can do that. And there's a trick that you can do that will help you, you know, to assure you that you're doing it at exactly the right time. And that is you just take a small piece of glass and lay it over where some of the carrots have been seeded. And the carrots under that glass will come up sooner than the ones that are in the open. And so as soon as you see carrots coming up here, you have to immediately go out and flame weed. And then you can...
Well, there's damp cloth.
Okay.
And it brings the seeds up really quick.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you can do that. I mean, we'll do that for the carrot bed, for the whole bed, just to help keep it moist.
Yeah.
We'll put a floating row cover over it. We'll water it and then lay a floating row cover on it. But I'm not sure about combining that with, you know, I'm not sure how that would work with the... Because that'll bring all the weeds up and everything.
No, we've had weeds that when we're raining seedlings.
Okay.
Like, not the direct seed.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
What about weed matting? You know, the product here, weed matting?
Weed matting, yes. Yeah. We use that. I'm gonna tell about that in just... Okay, so the next strategy for weeding is mulching, as we've already talked about mulching a fair bit. One way of mulching that is, you know, if you have 3 months or so that you can have to do this. It's we call it the lasagna method for weed mulching or it's not just weed mulching, it's for preparing a garden bed. What you can do is you take cardboard and lay it, you can just lay it directly on the ground. Whatever you have, you don't have to take out your grass or anything that's growing on the ground. You can just lay the cardboard on top of it. And then you put a layer of straw or hay or something like that, of leaves on top of it, probably 3 or 4 inches. And then you put a layer of compost on top of that. And then you can put another layer of straw or hay on top of that. And actually, it'll work best if you put some compost or, you know, some compost down before the cardboard. So the cardboard will keep out the, it'll kill any weeds that try to grow, and it'll kill whatever vegetation was on the surface of the soil by preventing it from receiving any light. But then, you know, it'll kill those things, but over time, the cardboard will break down. And so that's why I said you need time. But if you give yourself at least 3 months, you'll be at the place where you can plant directly in the top of this bed, and you'll have fantastic soil. You've just made some top soil there, you know, on top of your ground.
Can you do that around the fruit trees? Or
you could.
Control the weeds around there?
You could, yeah. I mean, you could think of all kinds of different applications for it, but it's a good way to make yourself a good soil if you don't have a good soil. So, but I think I've talked. So, yes.
So that takes 3 months to be ready to start doing this?
At least, yeah.
The meantime, I should get
it. The weeds?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be much of a problem. You know, as long, you know, the trick is if you're using hay can often have weed seeds in it. And even straw will have, you know, like if it's wheat straw, you'll often have wheat seeds in it. And so that would be the main issue there. If you can get hay from a field that was mown before, you know, in spring, before the plants went to seed, that's the ideal.
That can still work very well, especially if they're drawn. They don't speak in the grass.
Exactly.
We can't get to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You cut them, you simply multiply them.
Right. Yeah. And also, you know, for your, you know, we were talking about the rooted things, you know, that have a tap root or a running root. This will help to eliminate them as well.
Just one idea. Perhaps first create the pot up foot of the ground in a fire, put the ground go down and then spread the ground back. Would that be a good idea? Stop the creeping earth, lay the cardboard on.
That would probably.
Do you think it was maybe 2 years of grass free?
Well, the thing is, what you put back on the bed won't be weed free. You know, the soil that you put back, and you might have some of that creeping grass even in that. Right. Yeah, that's. Right. I mean, it would be worth a try. I've not done that, so.
You don't have that problem in your plantation, grass?
We do. But we have a grass that's called a Johnson grass. When it's mature, it'll be tall like this. And it has a fairly large root runner about that size that will run underground. And you know, it'll be 2 or 3 feet down in the ground running and then coming up. Of course, but it's at all the different levels from the surface all the way down running. And so for us, if we scraped off the top foot, chances are really good that we would have some Johnson grass in that if we put it back on. You know, we would be saving ourselves from the deep ones, but, you know, not the surface ones. So. So that's the lasagna method of bed making, we call it. But it's a kind of a mulching method. Another, you know, we've talked about wood chips and straw or hay and leaves. Another kind of mulch that is used a lot is plastic. That's, you know, farmers on a large scale particularly use that for, I mean, the thing we use it the most for is strawberries. And we, John started farming before I did. Is our time up? Okay. All right. So do you want to take a break or just continue for another hour? Okay. All right. So we use the mulch for strawberries. We have a mulch layer on the tractor, and we have an implement that makes a bed and then lays the mulch. But we have done it by hand. You can just buy a plastic roll and lay it out and just use a spade or a shovel to heap some dirt on the edges. You generally will want to go down once, heap the dirt on one side so you can pull it tight on the other side to heap the dirt rather than working your way. Or you can work your way down the bed, but you need to keep going back and forth if you do that.
We
make a raised bed like this,
yeah.
and then we lay the plastic over it, and down like this. And what we generally do is actually dig out here and throw this dirt on top. So the mulch layer behind the tractor does that. It scoops that dirt out with a disc, and then there's a following disc that throws it back on.
So it holds the plastic on the plate.
Yeah, so we put the dirt on top here. So when my brother John started growing strawberries, he really disliked the idea of using plastic. Now, that's the standard for all commercial strawberry growing in the U.S. But they say that there's enough plastic used just growing strawberries that you could wrap the earth several times. And, you know, it's just, plastic is a, you know, it's a bad environmental, you know, how do we get rid of it when we're done with it? And you can basically only use the plastic 1 year, and you have to redo it. So
vertically?
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Okay. I did see that sign.
Yeah.
Okay. So, anyways, John said, I'm just going to do straw. And so he did a straw mulch. And that basically, that didn't help him very much on the weeds at all. And like I said, you know, it's hard to, you almost have to come behind and pull all the weeds by hand rather than using a tool. So it wasn't successful. So then he said, okay, I'm going to use the weed matting. You know, because it's a woven mesh and it's breathable and reusable. And so he prepared a lot of this weed matting. The beds of the strawberry field were about 250 feet long, and he burned holes in it for where the strawberries would be, so that you could put that on and then transplant into them. And he did that for several years, and was doing that when I joined him on the farm. But after doing it for several years, he began to get the sense that maybe the weed matting was harboring disease. And so we said, okay, so the next year we said, let's do one bed with the plastic mulch, and we'll do the rest of the field with the weed matting. And that bed with the plastic mulch, it just stood out from the rest of the field. The plants were bigger and better. And, you know, why were they bigger and better just with a difference in mulch? You know, that's... Yeah, nobody really knows exactly.
Generated too by the fact ground much warmer?
Possibly. They're both black, so they would both generate heat in that way. But the matting is, because it's breathable, maybe it doesn't quite as much. But one hypothesis that some people have put out is that, you know, as we said, the soil is full of life, and that life is living and breathing, right? And so it's all that life is generating carbon dioxide. You know, it's breathing oxygen and generating carbon dioxide just like we do. And of course, that's what plants breathe, right? And so one hypothesis has been maybe that these holes, maybe all the carbon dioxide is coming up and out here, out the hole, and so the plant is getting a concentrated source of carbon dioxide. I don't know.
How is he doing drip irrigation?
There's a drip line that goes underneath that plastic. You lay that first underneath the plastic. Yeah, you lay that first. So, yeah, I mean, it is true that it's not just strawberries that people have noticed. The plants seem to do better with a plastic mulch than without. So, anyways, after that 1 year, we said, well, you know, we have our ideals, but we're trying to make a living, and we better just go with the plastic, even though we don't like it, because it just works better.
I use it awesome.
What's the problem with reusing the plastic? Is it just the little sticks or taking it off the ground and
it's a brand in the plastic?
Yeah, that's ours is not. Now they have come out with some biodegradable ones. Some that mulches like this. So that is an option. They're more expensive, and I'm not sure if we have used them that, you know, as of a year or two ago, the biodegradable ones were not accepted by the U.S. organic standards, which, you know, I would think but I think they were concerned. Yeah, they were concerned about some material in them, even though it's corn-based mostly. But for some reason, they wouldn't accept it. And we were certified organic. We, just last year, we dropped our organic certification, so we could potentially use that now. So, although we're not trying to, we don't want to, you know, we didn't drop it because we want to change our growing practices. We just dropped it because it's a hassle to keep it up. And our customer base is, for the most part, buying directly from us. Having organic certification is useful primarily when you're wholesaling. Yeah, because people don't know who the farmer is. If they know who the farmer is and they trust you, I mean, that's what we're trying to do, is build that trust. So we didn't really need the certification.
Are you using white or black plastic?
For the strawberries, we're using black, but we have done tomatoes, and we'll use the white on them because they're, you know, it's hot, and we don't want to increase the heat in our soil. So that's plastic mulch. It, you know, as much as we don't like it, it does have a place. So then the other thing I wanted to talk about was the weed matting. That is something that we have just started using on a larger scale, and not with our, you know, we stopped using it with the strawberries, but we've started using it in the rest of our garden. And there are a couple ways you can do it. you have a garden like this. These are your beds, and then these are the aisles. And outside, I said we have 18 inches there and 30 inches here. So what's how many feet is that total? That's 4 feet, yeah. So that's 4 feet from here to here, right? So one thing we have done is the weed matting comes in different widths. You can buy it in 3 foot width, 4 foot width, and I don't know what else. But there are different widths that it comes in. So we bought 4 foot weed matting, and for crops that we plant a single row down the bed. So these would be things like melons and sweet potatoes, crops like that. We'd have a single row down the bed. And what we did is we got a 4 foot weed matting, and we placed one edge here, dropped it down and brought it up like that. Okay? And that worked nice.
And you can follow the backing when you're harvesting your sweet potatoes.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how do you hold your weed matting down in the ground? You know?
We did you have a four counting
stakes?
Yeah.
Okay, you can do that. And we have a what we call a ground staple. So it's about that wide at the top. I mean, it's about this size. And it's maybe 5 or 8 inches long.
Metal.
Yeah, it's metal. It's an iron staple. And so we use that to hold the edges down. So I put one probably at least every 2 feet.
Close to the
two
plant,
or 3 feet.
Or where you put the
chair. Yeah. Of course, you don't want to do it right where the plant is. You'd want to put them in between the plants. But yeah. But it is, yeah, it does go down here.
I think that means how it
yeah. I mean, the one there, well, you put it down in the fabric.
We didn't put it down here. We just let the fabric go down. Yeah. Our beds are, you know, we don't intentionally, well, sometimes we do intentionally make raised beds, but for the most part, we're doing them flat on the ground. But just the fact of loosening the soil makes them come up a little bit. This is a little exaggerated.
Do you do it with a rugby hoe? A rugby hoe to bring the soil up? Because usually after you've been through with a rugby hoe,
yeah,
it brings the soil up a bit. So.
Is a rotary hoe what we call a rototiller?
Yeah.
Okay. We do that occasionally, but we try to minimize the use of the rotary hoe.
Yeah. Pulverizes the soil.
It'll pulverize the soil.
And it makes a hard pan underneath.
Right. So the application where we feel good about using the rotary hoe is if we've had a green manure cover crop and we're wanting to work it into the soil. Because the other thing that the rotary hoe will do, besides pulverizing the soil, it stirs everything up, and so it speeds up the combustion of your organic matter. So especially if you're in a hot place, your organic matter is just burning up quickly because you're in a hot place anyways. But when you run over it with a rotary hoe, it just speeds it up even more. It's like stirring up your the embers of a fire. And so we don't want to burn up our organic. Our place is hot in the summer, and we're just fighting to keep organic matter in the soil, and so we don't want to burn it up. But if the reason we're using the rotary hoe is to put organic matter in the soil, then we feel that's justified. So what would, at the most, we would do a bed or a field not more than once a year with that. So the main thing we use to loosen the soil is a spading fork and or the broad hoe, the broad fork that we have sitting out here. So we'll loosen the soil with a spading fork if the soil hasn't been worked. And then ever after, that's just the first time, and then ever after, you can do it with a broad fork. That's a lot easier on the soil. Did you have a question? Okay. Yeah. Yes.
How deep do you have the soil for the sweet potato? Because like in New Guinea, they make it up into a round bed like that.
Yeah. I just want to make one more comment on the other thing is that the rotary hoe, well, only does a shallow cultivation, and with the broad fork and the spading fork, we can get quite deep. We can get, you know, almost a foot down in the ground. So those are reasons we like to use them more. So for sweet potatoes, you're saying they make a mound and then plant them in it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they cut the leaves off the runners. The runners, so it produces more fruit.
Oh, really?
Mate, if you get too much runny, you don't get as bigger fruit.
Yeah.
Bigger tubes, you know?
No, I didn't know that. So I'm going to try that. Yeah.
It's like pruning.
Right. Okay.
And I eat the chips.
Yeah, I do know about eating the sweet potato tips.
So I just wondered how much gets spewed out in one of those beds for a sweet potato.
Well, we'll do it with a broad fork so it's deep. And I guess for that reason, I haven't felt that it's so important to make a pile because we've made the soil loose deep.
So how big would that be?
Well, it would be about at least, 8 inches to a foot. Yeah.
I think on golf courses and one thing and the other in Australia, you've probably got in America too, where they aerate the golf course.
Uh-huh.
And they come along, I don't know whether they use air compressed air.
Yeah.
They go down and with the machine, and it aerates the whole area very quickly.
Yeah. Well, if you could afford one of those, maybe you could do that.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. We use yesterday we showed a film on bed preparation, and it showed a spading, a rotary spading machine that goes behind the tractor. We like to use that rather than the rotary hoe. And it has a spindle with a number of spades attached to it, so the spades will be coming down like this. And they're on, how do I, if I looked at the shaft like this, there's things coming out, and then the spade is coming off of that. So as the shaft turns, the spades raise and lower. So they go down and then they come up. And then they go down again like this. And
like a cane shop.
Yes. Yeah. So that is easier on the soil than the rotary hoe. But it's pretty slow, and it, because you have to the tractor is, when John first got it, he had to modify the tractor with creeper gears. Now we have some hydrostatic transmissions that just slowly, you know, that just change as you go, so you can set it whatever speed you want, but you're just creeping along very slowly at about this speed. And but it's digging the soil, and it's turning the soil, but it's not pulverizing it. That's the good thing about it. It's not pulverizing. The other way that you can use this weed matting is my nephew John's son. He has a business selling farm implements for small scale farmers, and so he started dealing in the weed matting. And you tell him what spacing you want holes on your fabric, and he'll put holes in it, and then you put the fabric on like this, and it has holes in it wherever you wanted them. So there's the two options. This option here works best if you're just having a single planting on there. Now, one thing I have thought of, and I tried a little bit, is the idea of, you know, on my beds that have that are 4 feet on center, tried using a 3 foot weed matting with like two rows of kale, so that the kale was coming up here right next to it, and then the weed matting was going down like that. So there was just the space between the kale, and that space, once the kale has started to shade out the weeds, that space isn't going to have very many weeds growing. So you just have to cultivate that space once, probably. But you don't have to worry about the rest, you know, the aisles or the sides of the bed. So that's another option to think about in using the weed matting. And the nice thing about the weed matting is that it is reusable. Then the final strategy that just in the last 2 or 3 years we've started using quite a lot on our farm is using silage tarps. It's a fairly heavy plastic that's white on one side and black on the other side. And because it's a fairly heavy plastic, you can reuse it for several years. And what we'll do is we'll lay it on the ground it'll work somewhat like that lasagna method, you know, where we talked about putting the cardboard down. The weeds will try to come up and grow under it, and they'll die because they don't have light. So the thing is, if you can, there are two different applications for it. One is if you've got a lot of weeds in an area that you want to kill, you can cover them with a tarp and come back in 3 weeks or a month and they'll be dead. Then you'll have to take them off and prepare your ground. Another application for using it is to prepare your bed and, you know, get it ready for planting, and then cover it with that tarp and let the weed sprout. You'll want to water it first. So you prepare your bed, you water it, cover it. The weeds will be all happy because they got watered, and they'll germinate, and then there's no light and they'll die. So if you give your, you can, it's similar to the stale seed bed method. And you probably need to give yourself about 3 weeks to to make sure that you've accomplished that. I've tried it, and you know, not all weeds germinate at the same time. So there are some fast ones, and at 2 weeks, I'd taken care of the fast ones, but there were other ones, you know, that were still coming up. So, and I tried, you know, I told you we have this Johnson grass that has runners deep in the ground, and I had a large field. Well, it was about a third of an acre. It's not real large, but I covered about two-thirds of that in the tarps, and I started my garden in the third that I hadn't covered, and the idea was that then I would keep working my way up, you know, with new plantings, and take the tarp off as I went, and I'd have a weed-free area to take up. So by the time I got you know, towards the top of the garden, I think it was about 2 or 3 months. By that time, the Johnson grass had been killed under it. You know, it was trying to grow. It even poked up, you know, pushed up the plastic trying to grow. But
it eventually. Is there any studies in that done on how much heat you really need in the ground? Kill weeds, you know, you're talking about, you know, using flamethrowers or whatever.
Yes.
You know, does that kill a lot of the seed of the
ungerminated seed? The flame weeder, you would have to do it very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. And the way it's generally used, you're not killing any weed seeds.
Yeah, as long as you're not getting rid of all the microbial.
Right. Well, if you kill weed seeds, you're also going to be killing your microbial life.
What you've got to look at is the balance. Between,
exactly.
You know, what's
right. You know, you can if you do kill those things by heat, and I'll tell you a method of doing that. If you do kill them that way, you know, you can re-inoculate your soil by adding compost and we were talking about bokashi, the compost tea, or things like that. You can re-inoculate your soil with them, but you'd have to think about that
through your drip lines.
If it's clear, you could do that. We have not done a lot of fertigation. Yeah, we've mostly just used. We do have the ability to do that, but we just haven't done it very much. Yeah. So what I want to say is, with these tarps, you're not killing the weeds because of heat. It's the light, or the absence of light, that's doing the killing. But there is a method of killing. Killing not only the weeds but also the life in your soil, called solarization, and there are times where you might want to do that, and I'm thinking particularly if you have a persistent soil-borne disease in your soil. But I'm thinking more of a fungal disease, that's soil-borne.
Is sulfur allowed to be used organically?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
It's a great cleanser, isn't it?
Yeah. Right. So this solarization method. By the way, most harmful organisms in your soil will be killed at about 130-135 degrees. I was sharing that yesterday. That's Fahrenheit, and I just got a calculator here that okay, so that's 57 degrees centigrade. So the most harmful organisms will be killed at that temperature. But the beneficial organisms are not killed until you get up to about 71. So you have that window there. If you can heat your soil to that level, you would take out your harmful organisms and keep your beneficials. So yesterday we were talking about that in the context of compost. If you bring your compost pile up to that heat, you'll do that. So it's a little harder. You know, you can control your compost pile a little easier to keep it in that temperature range. And I think you need to keep it there for about 15 days to actually accomplish that. But it's easier to manage a compost pile for those temperatures than it is your soil. So this method of solarization, you take a large area. I mean, we've done it in hoop houses, doing it for the whole hoop house at once. You just cover your soil with a clear plastic. So this other method was, well, I guess it could be any kind of plastic, but a clear plastic is often easy. If you've got hoop houses, you know, you have to change the plastic every few years, and you've got, if you don't throw it all out, you've got some scraps that you could use for this. So you have to, you know, you can either throw some soil on this. You have to have it airtight underneath there. And it would be really good if you could run some drip lines underneath it. If you can't do that, you want to saturate this ground with water. Just make it really, really wet. But if you can run drip lines under, then you can water it while you're doing this process. And you know, I think actually your plastic does need to be clear, as I'm thinking about this, because what you're doing is you're letting the sun come through that plastic and heat your soil. And I was attending a conference where they were describing this. And I think, I'm trying to remember the depth they gave, but I think it got up to, I think it was getting up it to around 150 in the first inch, or maybe that was the top half inch. So, you know, again, that's 130 Fahrenheit is what you need to kill most harmful organisms, and the beneficials can survive more than that. But I think it was down to about an inch and a half or 2 inches. It was still 130 degrees. So they were using it to kill a fungal disease in the soil. And they felt that it was successful in doing that. I think you need to leave it for about a month. And so the secret is the soil needs to be moist, because that will help carry the heat. You know, I mean, it needs to be wet, not just moist, wet, because that helps to carry the heat down in the soil. But it, you know, they said it didn't only kill the fungi, it killed the weed seeds near the surface of the soil as well. So we have tried this a few times, not a lot on our farm. Yes. I am. In fact, I'm just going to start on that. Yeah. Okay. So, I want to talk about pests and diseases. And before I get directly into that, I want to give a little background ideas and thoughts. What I'm dealing with here is two different paradigms, two different ways of looking at your garden. And as I recognize these two ways, I recognize that they apply to not just your garden, but pretty much the whole of life, I think. I know they definitely are true in the medical field, and I think they apply in lots of other areas as well. So, but I'm going to present the agriculture model, and then maybe you can see how it applies elsewhere. So in paradigm number one, you have an insect pest or a disease, and that's the problem, right? It's the cause. It's damaging your plants. It's reducing your expected harvest. It's got to be dealt with. And so how do we deal with it? We've got to kill it, right? Let's get rid of it. And so we search for something that's going to kill that pest or that disease. I'm speaking of diseases are usually living organisms also. We're wanting to kill them. So our focus in this paradigm is how are we going to get rid of, how are we going to eliminate this pest or disease? In paradigm two, we look at things differently. We see a pest or a disease in our garden, and we say, that's an indicator that my plant is getting stressed. And I need to figure out what can I do to eliminate that stress from my plant. And so my focus is on the health and well-being of the plant. Okay. So I'm trying to find out what's causing stress. Kind of an interesting note that most of the time, not all the time, but the majority of the time, the problem is going to be below the surface of the ground, at the root level. Okay, there's usually, I mean, the simple one might be water stress, too much water or too little water, but then there's nutritional issues and other things that can stress the plant at the level below the roots. I mean, the whole plant is stressed, but the problem is a root issue in the ground. But you know, it can be too much sun or too much heat or other things besides a soil issue. So my focus in this paradigm is, like I said, how do I improve the well-being of my plant. Do you see any application of these two paradigms on other levels?
Yeah. Same. It's the same with sin in your life. You can either cherry pick it or...
Okay, good, very good.
And there's the old adage, prevention is better than cure, which is something we understand in health.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. You know, one thing that really opened my eyes regarding organic agriculture was before I started farming, John had started farming, and we were visiting. We weren't living there. We came to visit. And he said, you know, there's going to be a farm show day. You know, the state agriculture department is doing a farm show. And he said they're going to have a little bit on organic. They were going to be talking about berry production, strawberries and other berries and a lot of other things. But he said they're going to have a little organic in there. So I think this was just the beginning, you know, where they're just starting to condescend and do a little organics, you know, not much. So I said, yeah, I'd really like to go. So we went. And, you know, I don't know how those farm days are here, but there they loaded us into a wagon behind a tractor, and then they took us to visit different demonstrations, you know, a number of different demonstrations, different crops, you know, melons, squash, you know, a lot of different things. And I was really, really impressed. You know, we went to each demonstration, and they said, okay, here's the crop. These are issues that we face, you know, diseases or other things that we face with the pests that we face with this crop. And here's the product that you can use for it. We go to the next one. Here's the crop. It's how we grow it. These are the diseases and issues we face. And here's the product that can go with it. And there's actually a rep there, you know. And so the whole tour was like that, you know, one after the other. I thought, wow. You know, it's... So, you know, my dad is a medical doctor. And the medical field's exactly the same way. Yeah. And so that just opened my eyes so wide. I think you can guess we like paradigm two. You know, that's where we want to work. And so we don't like to focus on pests. We don't like to focus on diseases. Our focus is on how do we have healthy plants? What can we do to provide the environment that is going to make those plants flourish? This is, you know, how can I be life-giving? That's our goal. How can I be life-giving? Now, I do want to be clear that the divide between these two paradigms is not the equivalent of the divide between conventional and organic agriculture. Because there are a lot of organic farmers, particularly large-scale organic farmers, commercial organic farmers, who are using organic products in a paradigm number one method. You see that? So you can operate in paradigm one organically.
Same in natural health, vitamins.
Yes.
Supplements.
Yeah. Yeah. So it You know, I think it's really important to have that clear in your mind. Just because you're organic doesn't equate that you are operating in paradigm two. And I think I should clarify when we should talk about the organic substances that are used in paradigm one and even in paradigm two. You know, so what's the difference between those substances and the conventional ones? You know, why would organic be better in that case? The primary difference is that organic poisons are naturally derived. They're not manufactured in a lab. They might be extracted in a lab or processed in a lab, but they come from a natural product. And because of that, they generally degrade rapidly. So when a conventional farmer sprays his crop with a fungicide or a pesticide, generally he would like that to remain, you know, effective on the plant for a bit of time. When you use an organic product that way, that product is good for maybe a day or two. But almost certainly when it rains, it's done. You know, it's not effective anymore. So there's a much shorter, tighter window of time that organic products are effective.
I think a lot of these conventional chemicals now too, with the perimeters they've got, they will... withholding period is very short, because they don't want to get it onto the market quick.
Right.
They don't want things to be hanging around in the soil, so they break down the sun. So they are getting better. You know,
I think they're recognizing these issues, and so
it's not like the old days when you know, put builders in the soil and pass it for another 50 years.
Yeah. right. So, we prefer paradigm two, but at the same time, you know, we've got to be practical. And, you know, my plants got stressed, but that's my crop right now. You know, a lot of times, if my plants are stressed, And I get pests on them. I mean, there's not really any way to rectify that situation until I grow my new crop. You know, if I figure out what was causing the stress, a lot of times you can't rectify the mistake or, you know, what was there. You've got that crop now, and that you've got to handle that. And so I'm going to talk about a number of organic ways that we try to manage pests and reduce pest pressure, and even, you know, some poisons that we use. Now, we on our farm, we are very, very reluctant to even spray organic pesticides. You know, one of the strongest organic pesticides is pyrethrum, and we vary. You know, it's once every number of years that we'll use that. We very rarely use it because the thing is, in nature, you have... Well, you just don't see pests and disease running amok in the bush out here, with one exception. And the exception is something that's been introduced. Okay? But in the natural setting, without that exception, they're not running amok. Why is that? Yeah.
For every pest, there's a pest control.
Pardon?
So for every pest, there's a pest control that comes in this room.
Yes, that's right. So for every insect pest, there are predators that prey on it. And the disease is the same thing. And so that's why, you know, they are there in the bush. There are the pests and there are the predators on them. And that's how nature works. So it doesn't get out of balance. Where it gets out of balance is when a pest is introduced that has no predators, or a disease is introduced that has, you know, nothing to keep it in check. That's when it gets out of balance. So on our farm, our goal is to not necessarily eliminate pests and disease. Our goal is to keep it in check. And, you know, if we use something like pyrethrum, for example, it's going to kill everything. It's going to kill my pests, and it's going to kill the predators that prey on that pest. And so that's why we really do not like to use something like that, even if it's organic.
I think the biggest enemy we've got with anything today is Mrs. Housewife, sorry. But when she bites with her eyes, and she sees a little mark on the fruit, or a rough mark, or whatever. And I heard a program the other day, other people might have heard it, and they were talking about parameters that Woolworths, for instance, you know, the supermarket here in Australia, has just for their bananas. And it covers something like 300 pages.
Wow.
Of how they want their bananas.
You know? Yeah.
And for a banana farmer to get to that stage where he can supply them, he's got to be using almost every chemical in the world. You know?
Yeah.
And you just become a chemical farmer.
Yeah. You know?
And it's because of that lady going in and wanting a perfect apple or a perfect banana. And whatever, a little bit of grub mud or something on it, and it would save this country.
Yes.
A huge amount of money, you know.
That's true, and there is.
It's just the same.
There is a certain amount of, in the U.S. at least, there's a certain amount of awareness counter that, and so people who are wanting chemical free produce are recognizing that, you know, if there's some imperfections on it, that's almost like a badge or a signature that this is, you know, we have more assurance that this really is organic. It's not, yeah. But it.
That's happening here too.
Okay, but it takes an awareness raising and an education effort to help people see that. Yeah, but that. That is a big drive. I mean, that's probably the biggest driving force in using chemicals, is to have a flawless appearing piece of fruit or produce.
Fruit.
Yeah. Right.
If it looks too good, you
wouldn't look in it.
So I want to tell you about just as an illustration of this concept, Elliot Coleman. He's a organic garden writer. He's written several books that we really appreciate. He tells a story of visiting in Europe. He'd like to go to Europe because the Europeans tend to be a little more advanced in small farm techniques and technologies than we are in the States. And so he was visiting in France. And he came to a town where there was this man who had I think it was almost a couple acres under glass. It was a very, very large greenhouse. And what was really neat is that he had a store. He had a storefront where he was selling his produce and things that he grew. And you could walk out the back of his storefront into his greenhouse. And so there was a direct connection there. And Elliot Coleman said that he went into that greenhouse and he was just astounded. He said he had never seen such a diversity of things growing together in one place. So, you know, he had peaches and apples and limes, you know, all growing together. Underneath, he had strawberries and you know, every kind of vegetable you can think of. You know, both the cool season and the warm season, all growing together at one time. And he was just astounded at the diversity, you know, and it's all very intensely cultivated and grown. But what really blew him away was this man, in the center of his greenhouse, this man had an area where he was breeding pests, you know, the insects that would, he was actually breeding them inside his greenhouse. And Elliot was saying, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" And you know, because in America, and I'm sure it's here too, in a real commercial greenhouse, you have to go through a sanitary process to go into it. And he was saying this guy was just fearless. You know? And what he said is, "Yeah, I'm growing these because I'm also growing the predators that prey on them. And they have the predators have to have a food supply. Otherwise they won't remain here. You know, they'll disappear." And so he was keeping this balance going inside an enclosed environment like that. He had somehow worked it out. And yeah. So that's just a whole different way of thinking for most agriculturalists.
The biggest problem we've got is that, you know, we've got concentrations of huge populations today. You know, I come from a background where we've had to reduce quantities.
Yes.
Like, if you take 8 boxes of tomatoes into an agent, you say, "What are you doing with give me 8 boxes? That's a pallet space. I want a pallet 5. You know,
right.
144 on the pallet. Don't give me that." And it's really sad. This is how small growers get pushed aside. It might be a better product, but they want the bigger grower.
Yes.
You know, that they can sell by the pallet.
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah. You know, with our huge cities and one thing and the other, it's very, very difficult, becoming more and more difficult, you know, to supply the need for that bulk amount of food, you know.
Yes.
There, as you're talking about the two paradigms, you know.
Yes.
And it's a hard one.
It is. It is.
To really supply those people with food. If we were all growing organically and we all had our own little garden, we lived in a perfect Garden of Eden situation, it'd be wonderful.
Yes.
But it's not happening.
Yeah.
And it's continuing to happen. You know, the bigger cities are getting bigger. And
right.
There's no decentralization.
Yeah. I guess the way we're approaching that is that we feel that, well, for one thing, the only way we see that we can make it financially is to sell direct to the consumer. Because we can sell for a much higher price. And we have found that we have to sell for a premium price to really make it worthwhile for us.
Okay.
So, you know, we go into our high-end, I don't know if you've heard of Whole Foods, but we go in and see what they're selling for and we match that price or make it a little higher. You know, and that, I'm always wanting to give people a good deal, but I can't survive if I don't do that. And so We are selling to a population who has been educated and who really highly values our product.
Mm-hmm. So and it's a bit like in this country here, we're selling milk for $1 a litre.
Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous. It's like kicking a farmer in the face.
Yes, it is.
And when you see your product being sold below its value, it's growing value.
Yeah. You know, no, it has changed completely the way I think when I shop. Mm. When I see some produce for a really cheap price, the first thought in my mind is some poor farmer got a raw deal.
He's a new slave.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So.
At the expense of the big multinationals. You know?
Exactly.
They put on their specials. We were just saying here before, Aldi, believe it or not, are the worst offenders in this because we're trying to get a share of our Australian market here.
Yeah.
And I know because I used to be a wholesaler and buy out of the market. I knew exactly what they're paying for a product.
Right.
And I've seen grapes, cherries, whatever you look at. And so, how are they doing it?
Yeah.
That it's cheaper than what I pay for it in the market.
Yeah.
In the big markets, you know, Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, wherever. And they do use it as a loss there, you see. So they just sell it out for whatever price.
Just to help bring people into the store.
Yeah, so that they can pull their people in.
Yeah.
But what it does, it gives people a false impression that that's what the price should be.
Yes.
You see?
Yeah.
So they're educating people wrongly, you know?
Yes, yeah.
Their quality is not as good as cold food.
So anyways, we're just trying to grow for the market that we can find, that we can sell direct to, and hoping that, you know, we can do our part to make this kind of food more available and to educate people. And the more people we have doing that, maybe we can start shifting. You know, in America, the organic food sector has been growing steadily at about 3% a year. There's no other sector in the food and beverage realm that has grown so consistently and so much over like the last 20 years. And that is forcing the major manufacturers who said, you know, who wrote organic off and wouldn't even give it a second thought. They are being forced to reconsider, and now a number of the major food consolidators and sellers are buying organic lines, and they're starting to get into it. Even Coca-Cola and Pepsi are buying organic beverage, you know, companies as part of their product line now. Yeah. So, you know, it's a shift that is not going to take place immediately. You know, it's something that we have to work for. And so I think our time's up for now. And when we come back, we'll go into some specific ways of controlling different kinds of insects and diseases.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.